Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
This is Times Square, New York, prior to the start of civil defense drill, highlighting Operation Alert. The drill is part of the survival phase of the fourth such test held in this country. Less than 2 minutes after the take cover signal, the streets were cleared. Times Square is deserted.
Again, the fireball. Now, for dramatic effect, we superimpose it on the skyline of New York. The heart of the metropolis would be instantaneously transformed into an inferno, while shock and heat waves devastated the rest of the city.
Yes, once upon a time in America, people worried about nuclear annihilation, and there were elaborate plans for protecting the population from the inferno and its fallout. From the Baltimore Sun, this is Roughly Speaking, episode 345. For Thursday, January 18th, 2018, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for joining us today on the show. North Korean missiles, a false alarm in Hawaii, and a look back at how things used to be during the Cold War, when the United States and the Soviet Union came to the brink of real war.
American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger.
That's President Kennedy in 1962, addressing the nation about the installation of Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba, just 90 miles from the shores of Florida. JFK established a naval blockade to stop further shipments of weapons to the island, and he won a 13-day showdown with the Soviets, who agreed to remove the missiles after Kennedy promised not to invade Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis was the height of peril during the Cold War, when Americans were constantly reminded of the threat of attack from the sky.
Military authorities have advised us that an enemy attack by air is imminent. This is a red alert. You are advised to go to your nearest shelter area immediately.
That's the voice of a civil defense announcer during a test of the emergency broadcast system back in the day. In the 1950s and 60s, civil defense systems throughout the country used radio announcers to provide instruction for Americans in the event of a missile attack.
Put your emergency supply of food, clothing, bottled water, medicines, and first aid supplies in your car. Load all the members of the family that are at home now into the car and leave the area. Don't try to telephone anyone. Drive on the shortest possible route to get outside the city. Travel at least, I repeat, at least 50 miles from the city. Do not attempt to cross town or drive across roads being used by others as they leave town. Follow civil defense road signs and directions. Your car radio should be tuned to 640 or 1240 for official instruction. Remain calm and give everybody else the same chance you want for yourself to leave town. We can all get to safe areas if we act calmly.
This all seems quaint now, and even a little silly maybe, but back in the day, Americans were dead serious about preparing for the worst. They built bomb shelters. They took part in drills. Signs alerted them to the closest fallout shelters. People stockpiled food and water.
Federal authorities have indicated an enemy air attack is probable. We are not certain that it definitely will come here, but there is a chance that we will be attacked.
These days, with all the missile rattling between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, with North Korea's tests of missiles and threat-filled rhetoric, with questions raised about the mental stability of both leaders, some serious thinkers believe the risk of an attack is greater now than during the Cold War. A former Defense Secretary, William Perry, has said as much. It might seem like an abstract thought, an actual nuclear attack on an Asian neighbor of North Korea or on the United States, but the situation has injected tension into the atmosphere. Look at what happened in Hawaii over the weekend, and in Japan just a couple of days later. On Saturday, Hawaii's Emergency Management Agency mistakenly issued an alert about a missile attack, raising panic across the state. According to the LA Times, amid increasing North Korea threats, Hawaii had undertaken an aggressive effort to prepare for attack. TV commercials have warned the state's residents to get inside, stay inside, if a bomb drops. State officials have held online forums and town halls to field questions from residents, and on December 1st, the nuclear attack warning siren sounded in Hawaii for the first time in more than three decades. That's when the Cold War ended. In 2018, do Americans know what to do, where to go, in the event of a missile attack? What's the plan? And is there a plan? Culture commentator Sherry Parks was here the other day for her monthly visit to the show, and we talked it over. The last time you were here, we were planning a future show, and we thought we would talk about living with the threat of nuclear war again, which is something we haven't done since we were children, really. It wasn't something in the consciousness until Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea started going back and forth about missiles and big buttons.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Right?
Yes.
This is all in the atmosphere again.
Yes, yes.
It is and it isn't, though. I feel like because of what happened in Hawaii, maybe people are starting to think about this more, and then what happened in Japan. But this hasn't really been in the American conscience. We haven't really worried about this, well, certainly since the end of the Cold War. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I agree. And that actually is why we were talking about it, because it was almost a side story. Oh, by the way, these two people are talking about nuclear war. And I was talking to a man who grew up in Japan and who lives here now, but had recently been back. And he said, you Americans have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea what the level of threat is. You know, you have no way of envisioning what this would be like. You're imagining maybe dead people. You're not really coming to terms with the fact that if one bomb drops, you're talking about people with half their faces melted off.
Right.
And so that we really weren't facing the reality. And in the intervening month, the headlines caught up with us. And we've learned so much in the last few days about what we don't know.
About how we're not prepared.
We're not prepared as a country. I mean, people, Hawaii had dusted off its old civil defense stuff.
Right. Because of North Korea.
Because of North Korea, because right. the assumption is that if North Korea is reaching the United States, that they're closer to Hawaii than they are to the East Coast. But evidently now, at least by their own propaganda, they can reach the East Coast. But the idea is that we seem not to have a comprehensive government strategy. And what we saw in Hawaii is that, and this is true of my family too, that we don't have individual plans.
Here's a excerpt from President Kennedy back in 1961 talking about individual preparedness.
From the President's office, April 25th, 1961.
The annual civil defense exercise, of which this broadcast is a part, is a test of our program of peaceful preparedness. We do not expect war. However, common prudence demands that we take all necessary measures to protect our homes, our institutions, and our way of life, so that they can survive should an enemy thrust war upon us. It is true that your government, too, must fulfill its responsibility in civil defense with vigorous leadership. To this end, I have directed an intensive study of the whole subject of emergency planning. It is also true, however, that individual preparedness, which is beyond the province of government, is essential to an effective civil defense. For unless individual Americans plan to protect their own families, the most ambitious and carefully organized activities of government will prove inadequate. We are a people of strong faith in ourselves and in our institutions. We believe that our freedom and our liberty are worth protecting. Therefore, I ask you to support civil emergency planning in your local communities.
Do you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Do I remember it having lived through it?
Yeah,
no.
Do you have a memory from childhood?
No, I don't.
I do, so I'm a couple years older than you, and maybe I just remember parents gathered around the TV all the time, and Kennedy, it seemed like he made several addresses to the nation to update them on what was going on with the buildup of missiles in Cuba and the quarantine of Cuba. I don't remember ever being so frightened by something in the real world. You know, I remember being frightened by horror movies, by Dracula and Frankenstein, but this was a real world thing. The parents were really concerned about it.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas. Nuclear weapons are so destructive, and ballistic missiles are so swift, that any substantially increased possibility of their use or any sudden change in their deployment may well be regarded as a definite threat to peace. American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger. This secret, swift, extraordinary buildup of communist missiles in violation of Soviet assurances is a deliberately provocative and unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country if our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again.
Do you remember having drills in school?
Yeah, in maybe first grade,
rolling under
grade.
Your desk. I have memory
shades.
Of once.
By the way, we had dark green shades to pull down. You had big windows in the elementary school, very high, sort of like Palladian windows. And the teacher would once in a while pull down the wrong shade, and you'd see this dark green shade versus the other one, which was like a manila colored. And I guess that was to block out any light inside the school in case of an air raid.
There was this sense of preparedness that it was on their minds. I remember one drill rolling under the desk and the idea that the government was thinking about this. I mean, in a way, this is what we've learned, I think, since from Hawaii, because people were racing around trying to find their loved ones. Now we find you're not supposed to get into a car. Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I don't actually know what to do. I heard a man describe getting in the bathtub with his children in Hawaii and saying some prayers. I actually don't know what to do.
Right. And certainly there has been there are a couple of sensibilities that flew into this. There are people who are preparing for some disaster, some unknown, the Armageddon people, and you can buy cans of, 50 pieces of bacon and put it in your basement and things like that. And I think it certainly dovetails in this. But if you look at a responsible government with a responsible plan, and then the instructions, you and I would have followed them. I mean, this is what you do. You go into this part of your house because it's not like an earthquake. It's not like a snowstorm. What do you do? We don't know. And I think Hawaii, for whatever it was, told us that we don't know what we're doing and that we're playing with something that, and I'm using playing on purpose, we're playing with something that is huge, truly catastrophic. We tend to overuse that word, but this is potentially catastrophic, and we are not ready.
We'd lived through 9/11. So what happened after 9/11? What was the instruction after 9/11 about future terrorist attacks? People were so shocked by what happened in New York and at the Pentagon, but was there a follow-up? Sort of, hey, this could happen again, and this is what you need to do? I don't recall that.
Well, wasn't the message that it certainly could happen again, but it's not likely because we're going to war to make sure it doesn't happen again? That seemed to be the messaging. So I don't think that most Americans thought through I know individuals who took plans. There were people who bought cell phones or made sure that they knew how to text their children. But in terms of a comprehensive plan, I don't think there was one.
This is very interesting. So why don't we have a comprehensive plan now? Listen to another excerpt from the instruction that was given to people back in the 1950s and early 60s during the height of the Cold War.
If your children are in school, they will be sent home. Do not go to the school for your children unless this is a part of your school defense plan. Assemble stores of food, warm clothing, water, and medical supplies. Do not use the telephone. If you are at home, shut the doors and windows and pull down the shade. Turn off your electrical appliances except your radio.
Now, some of that stuff seems almost quaint today. It sounds like something you'd hear in an old science fiction movie. But that was real life. I had a sister who worked for... I still have a sister who worked for the civil defense. She was a secretary to a regional director of civil defense, and they had these drills all the time. They had these instructions all the time. They were putting up fallout shelter signs. Different schools or government buildings would have these, remember these yellow and black signs that said fallout shelter?
Yes, yes.
I guess that's where you were supposed to go in the event of an attack.
You know, my day job is at the University of Maryland, and it's big enough to be a little city, and it actually does have, I hadn't thought of it, it's interesting, as a civil defense plan. But after 9/11 and the storm that was that same year, they have a siren that goes off. At the same time, a text comes to your phone and your email goes off.
It tells you it's a test?
It tells you a test. I mean, they test it, I think it's, I mean, well, it is. It's the first Wednesday of every month. They do a test.
Hmm.
And they develop that, and there's a backup plan. Every professor is supposed to have an online version of their class in case there's an emergency. I think that was added when the flu was a big issue. But think about it. A university has that. Does the city or the state have?
I don't know. Is the general instruction shelter in place? Now, that's a phrase that I've heard since 9/11.
Well, and yes, actually, the campus police came around to the departments and identified in every building where you could shelter, under which circumstances. Because, you know, if it's an active shooter, you do this. If it's something else, you go here. And there's a person in every building whose responsibility is to remind us about where to gather. I mean, with the technology we have now, we could do that in neighborhoods, but we haven't.
If you have a place of refuge far enough away, go there and remain until we give you information that will permit your return. If you do not have a place prepared for yourself, drive at least 50 miles from the target area. Civil defense will instruct you there. Do not listen to rumors, and above all, keep calm. Your life depends on it. Keep tuned to this station for further information, and tell your neighbors to tune in also.
I want to talk a little bit about how this affects your consciousness as a citizen.
Yes.
I went to a concert a couple months ago, and I remember thinking, what if somebody has a gun in this place?
We do that now.
I mean, that's not something I thought very much about until the last couple of years, especially when we had these mass shootings. Mm-hmm. So it's the same kind of threat in a way, isn't it? I mean, we worry about missiles from the sky when we have plenty of violence here on the ground in the United States. I mean, we are an exceptional country when it comes to this kind of violence.
I certainly had a bit of a wake-up call because... I saw a notice that South Korea is having a humanities conference. And if your paper gets accepted, they pay for the whole thing, you know, the travel, whatever. And, you know, this is coming from the National Humanities Alliance. So it's legitness. And they're reaching out. And it's next October. And I thought, ooh. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute.
Do I want to go to South Korea?
Well, do I want to go to South Korea? And for the first time in my career, I thought, I need to talk to my family members about this. And I talked to my 22-year-old daughter, and the first thing she said was, don't die. Right? she wanted to have a vote in whether or not I went to South Korea.
You mean she didn't want you to go?
She doesn't want me to go.
Okay, so this gets to a point I'm trying to bring it into focus, and that is that for the past year, since Trump was president, we've had to think about things I didn't usually think about.
Yes.
Number one is, what's the president up to today? Now, I'm a newsman, so I'm curious, I guess, all the time about what's going on in Washington with the political system and the president, if the president has an announcement to make or is announcing new legislation or some executive order. It's of interest to me as a news person. But it's not something I want to worry about all the time. It's not something I want to really think about all the time. The President of the United States should make news when he makes news and then leave us alone a lot. I don't know how else to put this. I don't want to worry about nuclear war. I thought we were past that when the Berlin Wall came down. I didn't want to have to worry about being the victim of a mass killing or my kids going to some event and possibly being the victim of mass killing. This is a thought I didn't want to have. Yeah,
but now we do.
This is not progress to me. Progress to me would be you are freer of these worries in the modern world.
The same daughter, I only had one, was home for the holidays, and she wanted to go to New York for New Year's. And yeah, she's 22. I don't tell her what to do anymore. And I said, are you talking Times Square? And she said, no, we're talking Brooklyn. I said, okay, yeah, Brooklyn's okay. Mm. But immediately we both went to don't want to be in Times Square on New Year's Eve. And I think that is that sensibility. Now, I don't want to add to your worry, but another way in which I think we are complacent is that we have been told that we can knock those missiles out of the air. And, you know, we live in an environment where there are lots of people who work on those things. And this is not in any way official, but there's a great deal of doubt about our ability to accurately knock a missile out of the air.
Yeah, I can understand why. I know that we could detect it. The next step is, could you stop it?
Right.
I still have some residual faith that we can do that.
Because maybe we have to have that faith.
Yeah. I mean, we've spent all this money. We have all this technology. We're supposed to be an exceptional country, especially when it comes to national defense. I don't think I'm alone. I think there are people who doubt because they doubt a lot of things about the government today and the military, right? There's been a lot of doubt raised. You don't know what to believe, actually.
Well, that I think, especially for people like us who are trying to kind of keep their pulse on the national story, not knowing and not having a way to find out for sure is really problematic. I think the difference between now and 1961 is that the ground keeps shifting under us.
Yeah.
Even if then people didn't know the whole story, there was a story, and it was pretty consistent.
Here's the other thing. I don't want to just use this forum to knock Trump, but, you know, he does raise doubts. I'm not sure I have full confidence in his ability to govern. You know, actually, I think he's unfit to be president, but okay. But you listen to Kennedy's voice. Listen to Kennedy the way he speaks about what's going on in Cuba.
Neither the United States of America nor the world community of nations can tolerate deliberate deception and offensive threats on the part of any nation. We no longer live in a world where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril.
What do you hear in that voice, Sherry? What do you hear when you listen to that old recording?
Well, certainly he sees his job. And there's been something certainly written about this, and of news anchors at the time. They saw their job as reassuring people of we are in charge. We know what we're doing. We thought this through. It's very calm and measured. Although, I mean, his heart had to be racing because he knew the threat.
Would you call him convincing that he knows what's going on in Cuba and he has a plan for dealing with it?
It certainly sounds that way. And I think that is the role of a leader to keep people from panicking, because crowds of people panicking is itself a problem. And one of the things that I think Hawaii taught us is that we certainly have a lot of faith in technology. What happened in Hawaii is one individual clicked a button. I mean, clicked it twice. And
he confirmed it.
He confirmed it. We've all had this when, you know, you delete a document and it comes up and says, do you really want to delete that? It was just that easy. And he said, yeah, you know, want to do that. That kind of lack of checks and balances is irresponsible. That individual, that agency has gotten death threats. Well, that's not a structural fix.
No. No. Another thing people need to think about in this regard is competence in government. There's a lot of anti-government talk. We've been hearing it since Ronald Reagan was elected president, you know, where he made the government out to be the enemy. What was it he said, the scariest words any American citizen wants to hear is, I'm from the government. Mm-hmm. You're not the problem. The government's the problem. And then it's been amplified many times over the years, and we hear more and more of it all the time now. The Trump regime, the people he's brought into Washington to be in his cabinet, they seem like all anti-government people.
Well, but, I mean, they were brought to disrupt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the problem is we count on government for certain things. In Maryland, it would be emergency management, for one, at the bottom line, the National Guard, the police to protect us, good public health. So you need competence in government. You need people who are trained and smart and committed to serve the public.
And when things are going well, you don't have to think about those people. They're just there.
Yes, but in order for that to happen, there needs to be...
They need to be there.
They need to be there. They need to be vetted. They need to be people you can trust. They need to be trained. Mm-hmm. They need to be checked every once in a while to make sure they haven't gone nuts and they're going to push buttons they shouldn't push, right?
Yeah, well, and, you know, with this guy, there's no suggestion at this point that he went nuts.
No, like, he was a veteran employee.
Just
right?
wasn't paying attention, which is the scariest part.
But I'm not saying he's incompetent. I'm trying to make a general point about why you need competent government.
Yeah, and highly competent.
Highly competent. And stop complaining about government because you actually count on government for lots of things, whether it's a snow emergency or getting your kid to school on time.
Well, one of the things that Kennedy says,
we are a people of strong faith in ourselves and in our institutions.
I snickered because I can't imagine that statement being said today.
With a straight face.
With a straight face.
That anyone would be convinced by that. Yeah, that's where we are, I'm afraid to say. I mean, I still have some faith. I know people who go into government service. Just this morning, I was hearing the story about somebody who went to work in one of our intelligence agencies, the son of a friend of mine, and why he made that decision. He was working for a private company. He didn't feel satisfied with that, and he wanted to do more. He wanted to serve the public. And he's serving the public in national intelligence.
Oh, I do not doubt that there are lots of people in government who are good people, who went into it for the best of reasons and who are trying their best to do their jobs. I think that routinely, though, the rug is pulled out from under them. And I'm very worried about the infrastructure. I'm very worried about even the mission of some of those agencies at this point. And I'm really worried about their ability to get us all to move in one direction if we have a civil defense problem.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring this up because it makes me want to explore some more what actually is the plan. What are you supposed to do? What should you have in your house? You know, this it seems almost quaint to talk about batteries and a three-day supply of food or something like that. But we haven't gone over this checklist very much in our time. I think Y2K, some people, you know, stockpiled the spam and toilet paper in the house. But that was sort of a joke.
This has been a few years. There was an article that suggested that there were a lot of people who were very wealthy who were building shelters in their houses. At one point, it was it used to be you do the kitchen or you do the bathroom. But at houses at a certain price point, the most common thing was a container inside the house that you would go into. So think about that. If you were making the movie, you know, middle-class people or poor people will have no place to go. But the wealthy, the extreme wealthy, will go into their shelters.
I saw one within the last 7 or 8 years. I was in a gentleman's house. He was showing me his wine cellar. Then he showed me his safe where he keeps his rifles and guns. And then he showed me this room deep inside the house. It was all concrete, and it was stockpiled with water and cardboard drums filled with some kinds of food and tin drums filled with foodstuffs that he had purchased from Costco. Costco sells some sort of like $1,000 or $1,500 or $2,000 kit for emergencies, right? So that was a fairly wealthy gentleman who had renovated an old farmhouse, big old farmhouse, and he had this in his basement. And of course, during the Cold War, people built bomb shelters in their backyard. Some of them still exist out in Baltimore County. We've had stories about them over the years now and then. You know, it's too bad we're not doing live talk because we take some phone calls right now to ask people, how do they feel about this, and what are they doing about it? Have they made a plan for their family?
Well, haven't you thought about it in the last couple of days? I certainly have.
Yeah, I have. I'll end on this note. A cousin of mine lives in Hawaii, and over the weekend it was like 9 degrees where I was, and it was 80 degrees where she was on the beach. And she said, I'll put up with the phony missile alerts as long as I can sit on this beach. She's trying to make a little joke about it.
But it's in her mind.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is the new normal.
The point I was making before about progress, what I consider progress, is after the Cold War, less worries about nuclear war, about military buildup. And then, of course, terrorism comes along. And we had the 9/11 attacks. But still, you move on, life goes on, and you think, well, things are going to be better. And yet, we have wars, and we have mass killings here in the United States. And now, again, we have this talk about nuclear missiles, right? And you think this is the new normal?
All those other things, the terrorism and the mass shootings, as horrible as they are localized. Nuclear war is not. I mean, we're talking about a scale upon, a potential scale upon which we have not imagined. And I'm not a hysterical person. I just think we need to turn around and look this in the face. And actually what I'm responding to is, you know, I actually have seen a number of the Hiroshima films. I took a film class school where we watched a lot of the films. So I've seen the documentaries, and we have not imagined what this would look like.
If you look at it in terms of generations, when Hillary Clinton says or warns everybody that this man would have his finger on the nuclear button, I think at some point she said something like that.
It sounded rhetorical.
And for a generation, it might be meaningless. For our generation or folks who are older, it has a lot of meaning because it reminds you of the Cold War. It reminds you of the end of World War II. But for a newer generation, I don't know. Their ideas of that come from the movies. It come from the Terminator films or something, right? Yeah. It's not real.
Yeah, and you don't see the aftermath even then. It's a fairly sanitized view. And I'm not saying that people should live their lives like this, but I go back to your point about the responsibility of the government to have a plan, to help us devise our plans so that we can go on with the rest of our lives.
And to have a reassuring voice in the Oval Office?
Yeah.
That would be nice again. Thank you, Sherry.
Sure, you're welcome.
Sherry Parks is an associate dean in arts and humanities at the University of Maryland College Park and a regular contributor to Roughly Speaking. That's our show for now. We'd love to hear from you. Please drop me a line with your comments about the program. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.